Just to start off with, I studied history at university, so my background is in research. I've worked at the National Trust, record offices, and the Norfolk Museum Service, and I also now work for the NHS. So, as well as having three children, I've got a lot of different hats. So, to start with, who here has heard of New Haven Court? Any hands up? Anyone heard of it at all? Obviously, Phillida. No one else heard of the house? Nope. Is anyone familiar with the Lockerlampson family or the name Lockerlampson? Nope. So we're starting from afresh here. And is anyone familiar with Cromer? That's probably more of a likely one. Yeah, so most of you know Cromer well, which leads me on to the first slide quite handily. So what was New Haven Court? Well, it was the home of my great-great-grandparents, Frederick and Hannah Jane Lockerlampson. It was built over the winter of 1883 to 1884. And as to where it was, it burnt down in 1963. Actually, we're coming up to the 60th anniversary, which is January the 22nd. So almost 60 years next week, I think so. As to where it was, so as you go down the Norwich Road, if I can use my little pointer here, if you imagine the zigzags and you're going down to the beach, and most of you know the Cromer Church there, on the right-hand side, you've now got the Cromer School and the tennis courts here. Just on the left-hand side are now two roads called New Haven Close and Court Drive, and they are named obviously after New Haven Court, the estate that once used to be there. It was a 10-acre estate. Great, big square here. Hi there. That's okay, don't worry. So as you come down the zigzag, it was on the left-hand side. It was just on the brow of the hill, so it would have had an excellent view straight over to the Cromer Church and the sea beyond. So, first half of the talk, I'm just going to talk about the research that went into the book, how the idea started, and then the second half I'll just talk to you about the actual house itself and some of the fascinating, very famous guests that stayed there. So to start, we'll have to go back to this lady here. This is my grandmother, Jane Devere Madden, who was Delmar Morgan. This is her on Cromer Beach, both in 1939 and 1985, and the one taken in 1985 was one of the numerous trips that I was on with her. She often drove us up to Cromer. She loved the town, and she had a wonderful gift for, she was a writer, she was an artist, and she loved history, she loved family history. And while we were there on Cromer Beach, she used to tell us about a big house on the hill called New Haven Court that was owned by her uncle Oliver, a very charismatic uncle. And she used to talk about all the things she did in Cromer and all the people she met there. This is her playing with her cousins on the beach, just on the side there. This is her Uncle Oliver, who owned New Haven Court, that she always talked about. And she also talked about carnivals and princesses and meeting famous figures such as Percy Shackleton was at her christening. She met him there. This is Princess Ileana, and my grandma is one of these penguins actually in these outfits here, along with her cousin Ruth on the other side. So she always talked about New Haven Court. But as she got older, unfortunately, she developed Alzheimer's. And in common with the awful illness, she did regress back to a time where her memories were very clear and strong. One of the stories that she always came out with, and I was too young to really know who he was at the time, was obviously this chap here, Albert Einstein. She used to talk about having seen him play the violin and having bought a violin for him from Bonds, as it was then, John Lewis now, and having taken it to him at Cromer, where her Uncle Oliver was, and watched him play. Now, as I say, I didn't really know who he was at the time. I was too young. But the other thing she used to come out with was poetry. She was very fond of Tennyson and Kipling. But she also came out with this poem, and I'll just read it quickly, because it's a poem actually about New Haven Court, and she used to repeat this over and over again. Says, this is the house by Cromer Town. Its bricks are red, though they look so brown. It faces the sea on a windswept hill. In winter it's empty, in summer it's chill. Indeed, it is one of Earth's windiest spots, as we know from the smashing of chimney pots. In August, I asked for an extra quilt, because this is the house that Jane built. And that last line, she always gave a good flourish. So this is the house that Jane built. And the Jane that the poem is referring to is this lady here, Hannah Jane Lampson, who was her grandmother, my great-great-grandmother, who was always known as Jane or Janie. So she always came out with this poem. So from a very early age, I knew all about New Haven Court. I heard these stories about all these famous figures. But it wasn't until a few years ago that I went to visit my cousin in Dorset, and we were reminiscing about our grandmother. And she said, I know something that will interest you. And she went out into a dust, she lives in a very dusty farmhouse, there's mice, you know, running in the attics and all sorts. And she came back, and in her arms were these two volumes. This was the New Haven Court Visitor's Book. Now, I recognised these from when I was a child. I'd obviously been shown them. But as I flicked through them, I was absolutely astonished to see some of the names that were inside. I have actually got a copy, a photocopied copy of the book here, if anyone wants to look at it afterwards. But there were names in there like Shackleton, Tennyson, Churchill, Edwin Lutyens, the architect. It was full of these names. And obviously, as I got older and studied history, I knew all who these people were. As well as signatures, there were these lovely drawings, and there were little poems as well. And the other thing she brought out was this red volume here. And all of these had been saved by my grandmother, who was, as I say, a very talented artist. She also did bookbinding. And at some point, because she had this love of family history, she'd gone around to probably all relatives and gathered up letters, documents, anything relating to the family, and sort of curated it almost. So in this letters book here were letters from figures such as this one, there was Lloyd George. This one, I think, was William Makepeace Thackeray, the author of Vanity Fair. Dickens. The middle picture here, this is Kate Greenaway. I'm not sure if any of you remember Kate Greenaway or know who she is. Very famous artist in her time, she drew little quaint pictures of little children. She was a great friend of the family and actually taught my grandmother's mother to draw. So the KG here, she was known as KG to her friends. So this is from Kate Greenaway. And little sketches in these pictures. So I was absolutely amazed. And before I left, I said, do you mind if I take some pictures? And I snapped away, which is why some of these pictures have my hand in them, as you can see there. So I came away and I sort of had this idea forming in my head. At the same time, on the TV, there were the BBC programmes. I'm not sure if any of you have watched A House Through Time, which examines a building, obviously, from when it was built up to the present day, which I found absolutely fascinating. Very popular programme on the BBC. Obviously, Who Do You Think You Are as well, about family history. And at the same time, through Phillida, sitting there, I joined the Norwich Writers' Circle. And one of the first competitions I entered was a house history competition. And I got first place with that one. So I had this interest, had an interest in family history, the programmes on the TV, my history background, the research background. It was family. I obviously found this uncovered, this huge archive that had remained unpublished and uncovered. So the idea formed in my head to write this book. So the very first thing I did was I went through the visitor's book. Now, I started by going through every single name. I transcribed them onto a spreadsheet. The first thing I found was that the same people were coming back year on year. It was obviously a happy place to be, a popular place to be during the summer. And I also jotted down who'd left little pictures and poems. And like this one here, it's beautiful, at these two little figures on Cromer Beach. There are also poems here. This one was written by a relative. It says, from London's storm and stress we came to seek a calm New Haven. We found it, and then its kindly name is in our hearts engraven. Little poems like that I thought were lovely. So I found out who all these people were. I went through using Google. I went through who everybody was, and stories started to form about these people. They're often prominent members of society, and many of them had interesting backgrounds, let's say, and I started to think this would make a good, like I say, a good book. Some of the signatures were more difficult to transcribe than others. I mean, this little poem I loved, it says, Cromer at the Court New Haven, is life of all affliction shaken, no chance for care or sorrow, a certain cure for in the dumps, is here to play a game of bumps and feel it much tomorrow. But so I wanted to know who'd written that one. And but as you can see, can anyone guess what that name is at the bottom there? Anyone have a crack? It's a tricky one. For all the talks I've done so far, nobody's got it right. Believe it or not, anyone have a guess? Not quite. It's actually a chap called Beresford Melville, believe it or not. But when you look at that, it bears no resemblance to the actual name. So that's what I was kind of facing. It was more tricky than you'd think to go through it. At the same time, obviously being in Norwich, as we all know, we're not far from Cromer, I went to visit the estate, so where the house was. And like I say, there are two roads now, New Haven Close and Court Drive. And the roads follow the actual driveways of the old estate. So when you go up the road, it was actually the original driveway leading up. But although the house was demolished over the sort of 10 years following the fire in 63, there are little remnants that remain, little ghosts of the old estate. And if you wander around, you can find these. So with Google Maps, overlaid on a current map, I went up the roads. And the gate to the tennis court still remains at the back. This is Lover's Lane that runs down to the beach. That was the edge of the old 10-acre estate. And this here is the old boundary wall, which still remains as well. It's very, very high. It's about 8 foot high, very, very thick. And it still has the date stone there of the initials Frederick and Hannah Jane Locker Lampson and the date 1885. That still does remain. A set of steps that lead nowhere in the corner. And like I say, like a little exit for traffic there from when the house was a hotel. So once I traversed the site, I'd also talked to local residents as well if they're in their gardens. It was high summer. And I sort of chatted to them and they said some of the chimneys in their houses were made from the bricks of New Haven. Some of them had pictures of the old estate. So I was building up this picture of the house. Going back to the visitor's book, the other thing I did, once I'd found out all the names that were in the book, I went on to the British Newspaper Archive. Now, I'm not sure if any of you have used that, but it's a brilliant, brilliant resource. You can type in the names and search under dates. And it threw up some brilliant results. So I was able to, like I say, find the stories that related to all the people that were there. Obviously, the very famous ones we all know about, as I say, Shackleton, Tennyson, Einstein. You can find out about them pretty easily. But there were other people that stayed there that had these fascinating stories, which were largely uncovered up till I'd looked in the newspaper archive. There was love affairs, there were sort of secrets, as I say, from the title of the book, love, tragedy, heroism and intrigue, literally those four things. And on a sadder note, we think of mental health as a kind of current modern problem, but actually what I found in the 80 years that the house was on the hill above Cromer, there are unusual, well, I thought, a high number of suicides relating to the people that had stayed there. Even something as simple as someone who was suffering from terrible insomnia went home and shot themselves. I mean, it was an awful thing. There were suicides. Like I say, we think of it as a modern problem, but without the help, you know, that we have now, it was quite interesting to find that out. Another thing I did was go around to all the cousins who were around the globe and ask them, what do you have? Because I thought if all these things had come down to my cousin from my grandma, chances are other relatives would have other items and other documents, diaries, things like that. Now, most of us inherit something, whether it be a photo or a painting. And the cousins came up trumps. They were sending me items left, right and centre. One cousin from Scotland sent me this photo. Now, she said, on the back, she said, it says, Uncle Oliver at New Haven Court. So this is New Haven Court in the background. This is Uncle Oliver Locker Lampson. She said, but I don't know who the chap on the left is. Does anyone know who that is?
Shackleton.
It is Ernest Shackleton, yes. So he came to stay at the house in 1909. He was a friend of Oliver's. Shackleton, as well as obviously all his expeditions, tried to at one point get into politics, and Oliver was an MP, so this is how these two met. Shackleton also rented a house in Sheringham for a short time as well, so the families were friends, and I got some great letters from Shackleton as well that came from family members who'd inherited those. So now, I think the internet and social media tends to get a bad press. But actually, in writing a book like this, it was fairly crucial, actually, in finding people, that, like I say, the newspaper archives. And I know I don't want to go on too long because of time, but the one thing that the internet helped me to do, and particularly social media and Facebook, was to find the later residents of the house. Because I know, obviously, it was my family up until the end of the Second World War, 1946, and then it was sold out of the family. But you can't write a history of a house and not know who lived there afterwards. I needed a full history from 1884 up to 1963. So from the newspaper records, I found names, and it was often just a single line. So from typing in New Haven Court, Cromer, I found, say, a good example is Brian Wellham here, which I've written at the bottom. Now, Brian lived in the house in the 1950s as a 15-year-old. He now lives in New Zealand. But I actually found him because I went to the newspaper archives and I found one line that he'd caught a fish, a large fish. I'm not into fishing, so I don't know what fish it was, but he'd found some large fish off Cromer Pier and he'd won a prize for this. And it was one line and it said, Brian Wellham, 15, of New Haven Court. And that's all I had to go on. But from that, obviously, I knew his age, when he was born, roughly, and his name. So I went onto Facebook, which is brilliant, because I then messaged all the Brian Wellhams of the right demographic and the right age that I could find. Three of them came back pretty quickly and said, it's not me, but good luck. And then one came back and he said, it's me. I'm the Brian Wellham. I lived in New Haven Court as a child. And he came up with all the stories, first-hand accounts of living there, and him finding the house quite scary and lonely during the winter. Fascinating stuff, pictures. And that went for, I put Phil Shaw there as well. Phil Shaw now lives in Texas, also lived in the house in the 50s. His father was an American Air Force man, so he is American. But he loved his time at New Haven Court so much that he actually named his house in America New Haven Court, which is rather lovely. But without exception, every single person I found that's lived in the house, stayed in the house, said it was the happiest time of their life. Phil Shaw had many, many happy memories. These guys are now sort of in their 80s, but very, very, very helpful. And I've put the towel letters here as well. Now, Anna Jans, who used to be Anna Towel, that lived in the house, again, 50s. Her mother had saved, when the house had been sold out of the family, her mother had found in an outbuilding, in a shed at New Haven Court, a bag full of letters, lock lamps and family letters. And her mother, who's Josephine, had the foresight to hang on to these letters, thinking that they may be important. And boy, were they important, because they formed pretty much a whole pre-war chapter in the book. These family letters were very, very useful. And Anna herself was amazingly helpful, gave me lots of photos. And the boys who were there on the night of the fire, the Boyd Stevensons, I managed to track them down as well. So I had every resident from, obviously, my family all the way up to 1963. Moving swiftly on, just as an example of what Phil Shaw, the Texan, sent me, literally 5 pages of his memoirs about how much he loved living there, as well as photos that his mother took while they lived there from the 1950s. You can see the Norwich Road there. And I don't know if anyone knows Cromer well enough to know the New Haven Court Lodge. It's just been sold off the Norwich Road, but this is the only remaining building of the New Haven Court estate, which is still there. And it lies on the corner. It was the Gatehouse Lodge, and that's where he lived as a child. So I had pretty much everything. So I had all the residents of the house. I knew the history. I knew the backgrounds. I had the archives. But the one sticking point I had, as I put there, was exactly when the house was built. Now, this was trickier to establish than you'd imagine. Obviously, I knew it burnt down in 63, and I knew from newspaper records and these early photos that were in the Cromer Museum. You can see this one here. It says, from New Haven Court, 1885. You can see this is from the estate. You can see it's not been built up yet. There's no trees. So I knew it was around 1885. Obviously, the boundary wall with the date stone said 1885. So I knew I was looking around that date. But I was thrown off by various things. I know I was talking to a lady there about the Barclay family, but an old art book that was in the family showing the families on Cromer Beach. One of them had referenced in a letter meeting the Lockelampsons at New Haven Court in 1882. So I thought, well, is it 1885? And you can't write a book like this without establishing the exact date. So I went to the record office, I looked at Ordnance Survey maps, but these started in 1885, which obviously wasn't very useful. So I needed to go back. So tithe maps showed me who owned the land before that, but not exactly when it was built. So the way I got round, actually, I was very, very lucky. This archive in America. Now, again, just through trawling through archives online, I found this archive. It is in, I think, maybe New York, I can't remember now. Anyhow, I messaged them. They did say on their website that they had boxes of locker lamps and letters between Sir Curtis Lampson, who I'll talk about in a moment, and his daughter, the Hannah Jane, of the house that Jane built Poe. And there were several boxes, and it was during COVID, so with the time difference, I was emailing the archivist in America, going back and forth. And she said, look, I can copy you a box, but I can only copy you one box. And that's it, really, during COVID. So I had to pick the box which I thought was most likely to include something useful. So I looked at the date 1880 to 1885, and I struck gold, because what came back in those letters were the letters between father and daughter, literally describing the exact time, dates of the build. All the letters had the dates on them, and even down to when the bricks were brought in, who the architect was. It was, like I say, struck gold with that one. So then, now I had an exact date, I had an exact end, and I knew who all the people were, so I started writing. So I'm about halfway through. So now I'll just move on to the actual house itself, the Locker Lampsons and the guests. So the story of New Haven Court really starts with this chap, Sir Curtis Lampson here, quite an austere figure. He was born in 1806 in New Haven, Vermont, which is where the house name comes from. He was a son of a revolutionary soldier, William Lampson. He was one of 13 children in the end. He was a real businessman from the start. He showed skills in, I say, very hard working. He was working as a clerk when he was sort of 7, 8 in the local shop. His father was in the fur trade. His mother died very early on, and he joined his father and brother. And it wasn't long before J.J. Astor, I don't know if that name rings a bell to any of you, who is either his father, something about the Titanic, J.J. Astor, wasn't there? But spotted him as a talent and sent him to London as his agent. And by the age of 24, he'd set up his own business and moved to England with his wife, who was also another American, Jane Walter Sibley. And he was incredibly ambitious, incredibly driven, and he was a millionaire in the 1830s. You imagine what that would be now, sort of multi-billionaire, incredibly successful. He also helped lay the first transatlantic telegraph cable, and it was beset by failures and delays, and his perseverance and drive to get that done, Queen Victoria gave him a knighthood, so then he became Sir Curtis Lampson. He had 4 children by his wife. He had 3 sons and 1 daughter. I say by his wife because there were several illegitimate children as well, I've since found out. But his sons, someone once described them as the biggest bounders they had ever met, so his sons were fairly wayward. So a lot of his attention went into his only daughter, who was my great-great-grandmother, like I say, the Hannah Jane of the poem, The House That Jane Built. Now, she was born in 1846. The relationship between father and daughter was very, very close. Her son described it as being American in its tender strength, so all letters between them, he'd sign them off. Yours affectionately, your dad, CML. They loved each other very much. He took her on projects, and she was very like him. She was very driven, very ambitious. I think nowadays she probably would have made a great businesswoman. You know, she knew what she wanted, let's put it that way. She got to 27, she's still unmarried. I've got her diary, actually, from the age of when she was 18. And it gives a really good insight into her personality. She was really good fun to be around. She was very religious in a sort of American way, but she was also, like I say, good fun. There's stories about dancing with various men and card games and ice skating and shopping with her mother. But at the age of 27, still unmarried, like I say, very close to her father. And then she met this chap here, Frederick Locker. So she was Hannah Jane Lampson, he's Frederick Locker. Now, he was 25 years older than Hannah Jane. He'd been married before to the daughter of the Earl of Elgin, Lady Charlotte Bruce, and had 1 daughter, Eleanor. She died, though, and he was sort of looking for another wife. He was very much a man of letters, an old term. He was a minor celebrity poet. He'd written a little volume of poetry. But through that, he had friends in high places. pretty much anyone of note of the Victorian period he was friends with. Dickens, he left behind an autobiography where he talks about having dinner with Dickens, Thackeray, Dickie Doyle. Yeah, pretty much anyone of note of that era he was friends with. Crookshanks, Du Maurier, George Du Maurier. And these two met at a dinner party. And obviously very, very different. She's 25 years younger than him. Very sort of religious, moral, sort of upright, really good fun. Very much the opposite of Frederick, who was quite, as you can even see from this picture really, quite a sort of delicate, as I say, man of letters, a poet. Hadn't really worked a day in his life, I shouldn't think. But they hit it off immediately. Later, it was a very happy marriage. They got married in 1874. And she found his connections fascinating. She found him very interesting. And he found her sort of a tonic to his melancholy. So they really complemented each other. It was a very odd match. And some of their friends thought he was just after her money. But I think there was an element of attraction there. The opposites attract. So very soon after, children followed. Like I say, Frederick had one daughter already from his previous marriage who was grown up, Eleanor. But they had four children, Godfrey in 1875, followed by Dorothy, who's my great-grandmother there, in 1878. And then they had twins, Maud, who is here, and Oliver, who is the Oliver Locker Lampson of New Haven Court. But when she was pregnant with the twins, she was offered lodgings on the Isle of Wight with the Tennysons. As I say, they were family friends. And she loved her time there so much that when the children were then very little, she took lodgings in Cromer with Francis Hall, the Hall family, who were kind of a Quaker family in Cromer. And it was at this point that she decided she wanted a house of her own in Cromer. So, like many daughters of rich parents, she went to her father and said, "Will you fund this project?" And he said, "You find the land and we'll work on it together." So when the poem that my grandma used to say, "This is the house that Jane built," it was very much the house that Jane built with the help of her father. So she looked for a plot of land. Now, railways had come to Cromer in 1878, but the town remained really small. Unlike other places like Yarmouth, which sort of ballooned, initially it just brought sort of extra trade to the area and it remained a kind of small, exclusive resort. So this picture from 1885, if you imagine the church is here and the sea's behind you, you're looking from the church up the Norwich Road, and this here is the Norwich Road leading out. So the station, she picked a brilliant plot, because this is the house here, and the plot was right in the middle. The station was behind her there, obviously the main road, the thoroughfare into town, on the boundary of the estate. Cromer Hall was a genteel neighbour over here. She had a perfect view down to the sea and the church here, and over on this side was the Lighthouse Hills, and the lighthouse used to shine around once a minute. So this lovely plot right in the centre. But when she told her father, he was initially, being a man of business, and he had a lot of common sense, obviously he, you know, like I say, millionaire, he knew what he was doing. He didn't like the plot, and he said it was too near and not isolated enough, and he had the foresight to realise that very soon this was going to all get built on. And he was right, because in a few years it was completely enveloped. But it was a large estate, it was 10 acres. And as you can see, it's brand new estate. You can just see the driveway in the picture there that's been formed. But very soon they planted trees and it then became sheltered. But you can see how prominent it was. And it was actually one of the first large buildings in Cromer. And the houses that you see now with the turrets and the Queen Anne Revival style, they very much followed after New Haven Court. So it was kind of the trendsetter for the building that followed a few years later. So as to the first guests, as I say, Frederick Locker had a daughter from his first marriage, Eleanor here. And she was stunning, very intelligent, and a real catch. And she actually, from when she was very little, had been friends with the Tennysons. As I say, they were family friends. Tennyson had two sons, Hallam and Lionel, and Eleanor married Lord Tennyson, Lionel. So Eleanor became a Tennyson herself. They had three little boys, and I don't know if anyone knows The Golden Haired Alley, the poem, the Tennyson poem, but that's written about one of her sons, little Alfred there. And there's Charlie. Charlie became a great historian himself and wrote lots of books about the house and the family and staying there. And that was one of the resources I used. But it's all covered in the book. I won't go into too much detail with the time. But Eleanor, as well as being very bright, clever, attractive, both her and Lionel, despite a promising start and being friends from childhood, they both set about having affair after affair. Very flirtatious, the both of them. It wasn't just one or the other, it was both of them. And in the 1880s, they were offered a trip by the India Office to go and kind of do a, a trip to India. But on the way back, poor Lionel got malaria and died, and he was buried in the Red Sea. And Eleanor came back a widow. But when she came back, she retreated straight back to New Haven Court and her father. But also staying there at the same time was the daughter of William Makepeace Thackeray, Annie, who's now Annie Ritchie. And Annie Ritchie and Eleanor were friends, and Eleanor set about having an affair with her best friend's husband, Richmond Ritchie. So there were affairs playing out under the roof very early on. But yeah, Eleanor and the Tennysons were early visitors. Tennyson was often seen. He was very much grieving. They're very close families, very close to his sons, and he was in deep grief for Lionel when he came to New Haven Court. And he was often seen on the Lighthouse Hills or on Cromer Beach, shoes in hand, sombrero and his cape, walking along. Sometimes he would just ruminate for hours in the gardens of New Haven Court. They were early guests, the Tennysons. The house was filled initially, like I say, Frederick Locker was a poet. And by this point, the families had become the name Locker Lampson because Sir Curtis had died in 1885. So he built this house with his daughter, but he then died. And the family, as part of his will, he said, you can have the house, but you've got to be Locker Lampson. So that's where the name came from. But the early years were filled with Frederick Locker's friends, like I say, artistic, poetic. And this here is Kate Greenaway, like I said at the beginning. She was a great friend of the family. Frederick Locker had sort of championed her work from when she was very young. And yeah, she was very much a favourite of the children. She used to wander down to the beach with them, and with the tip of her umbrella or her parasol, she'd draw figures in the sand, and the children used to then watch them being washed away. I've got lovely descriptions of that. The chap on the right, most of you will recognise, is Oscar Wilde. Also another friend of the family, being in those similar circles. And he came to play tennis up at the house. But by this point, he was quite a large man. He was quite a big man. And I've got a not... I have to find it somewhere later on, but a not too flattering description of him in his tennis whites playing tennis up at the house. So, the early years were a lot of sort of poets, writers, literary figures. But then Frederick Locker, as I say, he was 25 years older than Janie. He died in 1895. By this time, their children were growing up, and they started inviting back to New Haven Court their friends. Like I say, the central figure there, Oliver, he was the younger son. As you can see from this, I think the photo tells you a lot, really. He was very much sort of a dandy figure. He'd been to Eton, Cambridge. He'd studied history there. And while he was there, he met this chap here. I don't know if anyone recognises him, M.R. James, the ghost story writer. He was a friend of Oliver's, spent many, many summers at New Haven Court. And I've got a great poem written by him in the visitor's book if anyone wants to see it later. Oliver then moved into politics, and through that, he then became friends with Winston Churchill. And I say there's Shackleton at the bottom there, another picture of him outside New Haven Court. But Churchill came to stay at the house in 1912. And Oliver, it was one of many visits he made. At the time, he was in the Admiralty, and he'd arranged with Oliver that him and Clementine would stop on their... They'd moor up off Cromer on their ship, the Enchantress. But it was August 1912, and Oliver and his mother, Janie, they had a whole weekend planned, a golf, dinner parties. They had Harry Gordon Selfridge, the retail magnate, was due to have dinner with them that weekend. But the weekend came and it was unusually rainy. It was drizzling. They could barely see the ship out to sea. And it was a portent of what was to come. And the Churchills managed to get onshore. So Oliver went in a boat, got them back. They did motor up to New Haven Court. They had a light tea and supper, but the weekend had to be cut short because of the weather. And it was just dreadful. It was rain, like I say. Terrible, terrible conditions for August. And does anyone know what I'm going to say next? Why it was so bad? August 1912. Is that date? The Norwich floods. It was the weekend just before the awful floods. And that was why the weekend was cut short. So he left on the Sunday, Monday, we had the terrible floods. So the weather was a portent to come that weekend and it cut their trip short. So pre-war, the house was just filled, as I say, with these lovely figures of Shackleton, Tennyson, Churchill, Oscar Wilde, Kate Greenaway. Very, very happy home. These are just some family snaps there. As the children grew up, there were grandchildren. This is Hannah Jane, the widow, very much the dominant figure at New Haven Court. They used to take little trips out onto the Broads. They had a sailing boat, Mansura, picnics in the grounds, things like that. But then, of course, skipping ahead. 1914, and war comes along. Now, immediately, the men of the house go to join up. Godfrey joined the Royal Wiltshire Yeomanry. There he is. Conway, who was the husband of Maud, Oliver's twin, he rejoined the Grenadier Guards. He'd been in the Boer War already, veteran, but immediately joined up. And Oliver started to think where he'd be useful. Now, as I say, Oliver was a very, very colourful, charismatic, and a rather eccentric figure. And because he had links with Churchill, as say the Admiralty, and without going into too much detail with time, he was also involved with Duff Morgan and Vermont, the Vermont being Oliver's share in the business. So he had a background with cars. And he decided to use his own personal fortune to form a kind of private army, which one relative called it, a very odd squadron, an armoured car squadron. And they went to France, but being armoured cars and trench warfare, they weren't very useful over there. And it ended up, Oliver was a great opportunist, and when he thought the unit was going to be disbanded, he overheard a Russian say that the cars should go to Russia. And then he somehow engineered himself to get to Russia with his armoured cars. Very little known story of the Great War. But Oliver's son is still alive, his younger son, because Oliver had him quite late. And he told me his father was a man who managed to ingratiate himself with people wherever he went. And it was very true. While he was in Russia, he managed to engineer a meeting with the Tsar of Russia himself, Tsar Nicholas. Obviously, just before the abdication, he had dinner with the Tsarevich and the Tsarina. And while he was also in Russia, he went down to Romania. And while he was in Romania, he heard that Queen Maria of Romania was hiding out in a palace in the corner of Romania that had been unoccupied. And he, thinking she might be short of rations, he drove up to the house, the palace himself, with rations. And he made friends with Queen Marie and her children. And the couple became very close, and a great friendship which lasted his whole life. So while he was in Russia, he managed to engineer these meetings with the Tsar, Queen Marie. Back at New Haven Court, Janie was housing Belgian refugees, very much like the Ukrainian crisis now. Janie and Oliver put out feelers to see if there are any local people who could house these refugees. And it's forgotten about now, but many, many Belgians came over here when the Germans invaded. They came over to England. Most of them went back after the war. But there were Belgian refugees at New Haven Court. But moving swiftly on, Janie suddenly dies in 1915 at the beginning of the war. And Oliver, being the younger son, inherits. So Godfrey gets the principal home, which was in Sussex, called Rowfant, and Oliver, being the younger son, gets New Haven Court. So Oliver comes back from the war, and he's now the sole owner of New Haven. He lost a lot of money in the war. His armoured cars were confiscated by the Bolsheviks, and he was looking, you know, he had to update New Haven Court. It needed rewiring, plumbing, all sorts of things. And so he decided to make it into a kind of private guest house in the 1920s, the early 1920s. Having always been a bachelor, he was now in his 40s, early 40s. He suddenly met, to the surprise of his friends, met this lady here. Very, very glamorous. This is Bianca. She was always known as B in the family, Bianca Paget. She was described by excited journalists as being Californian, but actually she was the daughter of a Welsh grocer. So, once you look at the records, that's where she came from. But she was the very picture of 1920s glamour. And between them, they were kind of a power couple. She complimented him in the same way that Janie had complimented Frederick. They put in a ballroom, a lovely pavilion outside. She hung the house with these beautiful lights. And the other thing they did, which is what New Haven Court is mostly remembered for in Cromer today, they built two huge indoor tennis courts at the cost of £10,000, which was a huge amount at the time. But as well as the party, if you imagine 1920s parties and glamour, that was New Haven Court at this period. These huge tennis courts were built in the corner of the estate. This is a picture of the tennis courts. You can see the balcony that used to run around the outside. But they attracted the very, very top players of 1920s tennis. Suzanne Longlong, I'd never know how to pronounce her name, was a French superstar. She was a celebrity of her time. She used to be known for wearing her furs. You can see her wearing her furs outside New Haven Court here. There's Bianca, Oliver's wife, and there's Oliver himself there. But she was known for wearing furs, and she did like a drink, and apparently she used to have her father throw down ice cubes soaked in brandy from the stands to her, which she'd catch and pop in. But, so again, like Oliver, he'd made friends with all these European royalty, and now he'd managed to, it was a great coup, he'd managed to get Suzanne Longlong there. And this is him saying goodbye just outside New Haven Court. I found this great cache of pictures. As I say, in the 1920s, great house parties, Bianca and Oliver. And this lady here, as I say, Oliver had made friends with Queen Marie of Romania during the First World War. And in 1925, Marie said, would her daughter, Princess Ileana, be allowed to come and stay for some, quote, seaside air and sports? And Oliver said, absolutely, bring her across. And he invited all of his nieces and nephews down as company. This is my grandma's sister here, dressed as a jester there. And this was the beginning of what we now know as the Cromer Carnivals. This was 1925. It was very much initiated, the modern carnival, by Oliver. So he had this great fancy dress opening. And Princess Ileana is the fairy queen. William Bull, the MP here, it's dressed as King Neptune, I think it is, and like I say, jesters. The car was covered in flowers, and they drove that down to the pier and opened the carnival. Princess Ileana was very, very popular with the children. She became actually godmother, I think, to several of my grandma's cousins, I think. But the next year, Oliver hosted her sister, who was then Elizabeth of Greece, Prince Philip's aunt. And they'd been deposed at that point from Greece. But they were much more miserable, and the children didn't really like them. They thought they were quite boring and hard work. So he'd had the Greek royals to stay. He'd had Princess Ileana, the carnivals, the parties, the tennis. But suddenly, in 1930, very tragically, Bianca, his young, glamorous wife, dies aged 30 on Christmas Day. She had pancreatitis, which is quite an unusual thing to have at the age of 30. It could just be chance, of course, and you don't want to assume, but it can be also linked with alcohol consumption. So we don't know why that came about, but Oliver was heartbroken, as you can imagine. There's her grave there. She's buried alongside Frederick Locker, his father, all of the Locker Lampsons in the Worth Churchyard in Sussex. Now, Bianca had been, as I say, his partner in every way. This is him meeting constituents with Bianca. So she was a part of his whole life. And when she died, the life sort of went out of New Haven. At the same time, it's the Great Depression. The house was losing money. And he'd obviously overspent. One of my cousins, who remembers Oliver, said that he never had any money, but he was good at spending it. And he'd probably been brought up, hadn't he, in a time where, his family were very wealthy. And suddenly, you know, he wasn't doing very well. So, although he retained shares, the house was then taken over by a Swiss hotelier called Maurice Pierre Berset, who moved in with his wife Irene and his daughter Judy. Now, I don't know if you can just about make that out with the bottom there, but this is a tapestry that someone found for me in Chroma. It's a great big thing like this. It was a real find. And I love it at the bottom there. It says IB, 1936. That's Irene Berset, who moved in. And the the Berset's were incredibly talented hoteliers and again brought the life back into New Haven. If you imagine in 1930s, you know, hotel, that was it at the time. There were still very famous figures to stay. Prince Philip, as a boy, stayed at New Haven Court. Many of you may know that he didn't really have a home as a child. He was sort of moved around to relative after relative. And as I say, Oliver knew the Greek royals, and through that, Prince Philip stayed as a boy. And he actually wrote about Oliver Lockerlampson, and he remembered him very clearly. And in a book that was written in the 70s about the armoured cars in Russia, Prince Philip wrote the foreword, and he said it's testament to Oliver's character that he actually remembered him so well, and he remembered staying in the house in Cromer. So Prince Philip was there at this point. And possibly the most famous guest of all. Now, Albert Einstein, there, Oliver on the horse. Oliver had taken, as I say, got markedly more eccentric as he got older. And since the First World War, there's possibilities he may have been suffering from tuberculosis after the war. He took to sleeping outside, and he rented a piece of land in Rowton Heath, just near to Cromer, a few miles up the road, where he put some bell tents and he built these lodges here. This is my grandma here visiting Oliver. There's Oliver with his Great Danes. So he was sort of living in these tents, although he went back to New Haven Court. Oliver had studied German when he was at school in Cambridge, so he could speak fluent German. And Einstein, in 1933, had come back from America to find there was sort of a price on his head by the Nazis. And he was offered sanctuary by King Albert of Belgium. Now, Oliver, as he knew all the other royals, knew King Albert of Belgium, had taught that royal to ski. And through this association, as I say, Oliver was a great opportunist, and he wrote when there was a sudden threat on Einstein's life in September 33. He wrote and said, come over, I can offer you sanctuary in Norfolk. So that's how, to cut a long story short, Einstein ended up in Cromer. So the story about my grandma taking a violin to Einstein and watching him play was absolutely true, because she was there that late summer of 33. So we come up to, again, the next war, 1939. Cromer was very badly hit. This is Church Street. If anyone knows Church Street, the church is here just behind these buildings. Absolutely bombed out. New Haven Court was requisitioned, like all the other hotels in the town. But it escaped fairly it didn't get a direct hit, although there's records there was a small fire in one of the outbuildings. But it did become then a little bit run down. Obviously, the troops had been in there. So after the war, 1946, it was sold on to a businessman who ran a chain of hotels called Roy Walter Marsh. He ran it for a few years. It was struggling in a kind of post-war climate, like everything was. As you imagine, running a hotel when there are shortages of everything. It never made much money. There were attempts over the following years to develop some of the land around the building, but never quite got permission. At one point they wanted to make it a caravan park, but that was also denied. And then he sold it, and the person he sold it to was this chap in the middle here. Now, he was a giant of a man. He was well over 6 foot, and his name was Harold Alfred Towle, known as Bill to his friends and family. As much as Sir Curtis had been a businessman and I can never say the word, entrepreneur, he was very similar. He'd actually overheard, and I say I'm in touch with his daughter, who told me this story firsthand, but he'd overheard somebody talking in a furniture shop about how the American troops that were stationed in RAF Sculthorpe had nowhere to stay. So he bought the building with the idea of turning it into a transit hotel for RAF, not RAF, American Air Force servicemen. So that's what it was in the late 1950s. So as I say, I'm in touch with Anna, who lived on the estate, and this is just one of the American servicemen sort of magazines. It had every amenity available. It had sort of like a creche there. It had a pleasure boat on hand for the American troops. So very well treated there. And the chap from America, the Texan I mentioned at the beginning, he sent me this picture of some troops playing on the coast, playing football up at the coast. So for a short time, it was a transit hotel. Now, Bill Towle, I say, was a businessman. He was always looking to make money. And at this point, he sold some land on the southern boundary, which is now the road of New Haven Close. And that's it in development. So he'd sold off some of the land on the boundary. The hotel was in the hands of the troops. But in 1961, in January 1961, the tennis courts, which were the huge draw of New Haven Court, caught on fire. 3 o'clock in the morning, the night watchman heard crackles and the whole thing went up. It was glass and asbestos, and once it caught on fire, it just went. And it really began the decline of New Haven. Very soon after that, Senator Al Gore in America decided to cut spending on the troops abroad, and New Haven, the troops were pulled from New Haven Court. So it then sat empty for a while until we had the last owners, who were the Boyd Stevenson family, moved in the summer of 1962. And they ran it for just a few months until January 1963, like I say, nearly the 60th anniversary. Fire breaks out in the roof. And I know from the boys, that I've talked to them, interviewed them, they were sitting having tea in the hotel lounge when somebody ran in and said, "Do you know the roof is on fire?" They'd had no idea, and they came out. Now, some of you may remember the winter of 1962 to 63 is being exceptionally cold, and it was that winter. And the firemen who came to try and put out the fire hydrants were stuck solid. It was so icy, the firemen who were trying to put out the fire were slipping and sliding. Their tunics were frozen solid. One of the firemen who was there that night left behind a really good record of literally his memories of being in the fire that night and tackling the blaze. They did manage to confine the fire to the top floors, but the water damage that ran down the wood panelling buckled and ruined everything, basically. The water damage, the smoke damage, and it was beyond repair. And at that point, it was sold back to a builder. And therein lays the sad end of New Haven Court. So, like I say, it was demolished in the following 10 years. And the roads now are, like I say, New Haven Close and Court Drive. And I know I'm going to stop there because we come up to 2 o'clock. Has anyone got any questions?
Yeah, who was the architect of the house?
It was a chap called John Bond Pierce, who ran, he was from Norwich. He had his offices at Surrey Street. He was responsible for the Great Yarmouth Town Hall quay on the quayside, if you know that. And if you actually look at that building, you can see its similarity in style. He also was responsible for the Agricultural Hall on Bank Plain as well. So it was that architect. And the builders were Cubitts of Cromer.
Okay.